It's good to see this number out again tonight. We have a very good number. We have a lot of family with us that used to be with us a lot. And so it's good to see them. Good to see all of you tonight. I want to begin just a quick... Well, I say quick. Be careful. Preachers have to be careful when they say words like quick and just a few minutes and all that. But a quick overview of the Psalms, okay? And I know I've shared this several times through the years, but just something to kind of help us get in. We're going to look at one of the Psalms tonight, okay? Just to, real quickly look at that, but we will, just to kind of help us a little bit though, the Psalms are wonderful, okay? And I know you all know this, so I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. The Psalms are wonderful to help us in all situations that may come up or arise in our lives, okay? And they were written, but let's look at some things about the origin of the word Psalm, okay? From the Greek word there, psalmos, psalmos, it literally means, the Hebrew, to pluck, okay? Taking hold of the strings of an instrument with the fingers. It implies that the Psalms were originally composed to be accompanied by a stringed instrument, okay? Psalms are songs for the... This is from Kyle and Dalich in their... this one little part right here. In their commentary, they have a commentary on all of the Old Testament, by the way. It's a very good commentary, but it's in Psalms, it says the Psalms are songs for the lyre, L-Y-R-E, okay, and therefore lyric poems in the strictest sense. And we can all kind of see, I don't know about you, but I can picture in my mind David, okay, I can picture David being out maybe keeping the sheep and he's got his harp. Okay, and he's maybe singing some of the psalms. Maybe he's writing them and singing them and kind of going through and plucking the harp, the strings of the harp, you know, while he's doing that and going through that. In the New Testament worship, and I bring this up because we all don't know this, and I want to make sure I don't leave anybody with the wrong impression, right? We are told to sing the psalms to the accompaniment, not of the harp, with a P, but with a heart, H-E-A-R-T, okay? Ephesians 5 and verse 19 talks to us about singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, right? Singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. Now, the phrase making melody comes from the Greek word that literally means, once again, pluck the strings of, okay? Pluck the strings of. But it specifies what that is. Pluck the strings of the heart, H-E-A-R-T, okay? So, thus, we are to pluck the strings of the heart as we sing the psalms, not the strings of a harp, okay, in the New Testament in our worship, okay, to them, from Ephesians 5, 19 and 20. But the word literally meant, the psalm literally meant to pluck, okay, to pluck. Okay. The authors of the Psalms, and this is something that I know you're not going to be able to read all that, and I apologize, I know it's very small there, but when you think of the writers of the Psalms, right, the first thing you think of is David, right? Well, there's 150 Psalms, but yet David is only attributed with 73 of those Psalms. Now, those are 73 that he actually puts his signature on, if you will. Okay, now, so there may be others. Okay, if you look at the bottom there, there's a man named Anonymous. Okay, but that means we don't know who wrote them. Okay, 48 of the Psalms are anonymous. There's not a signature on those. Now, David may have wrote most of those, right? You know, we don't know for sure, but it could have been Solomon, right? Solomon was known to write many Psalms. Okay, and Solomon only has his signature on two of those Psalms. Psalm 72 and 127 have his name on them. There are other men, though. Asaph. He was the music director during the reign of David and Solomon. He wrote 12 of the Psalms, okay? 12 are attributed to him. The sons of Korah, we hear that sometimes. These were Levites who served in the temple. They wrote 12 Psalms themselves. We already talked about Solomon. Moses, Probably wrote the earliest psalm. We talk about Psalm 90. Have you ever read that? It's a wonderful psalm. Sometimes it's used maybe like in a funeral or something, or in a eulogy thing. It's a beautiful psalm there, teaching us to number our days. Remember that? He talks about that in Psalm 90. Heman, he was a contemporary with David and Asaph, also known as the singer. Okay, he wrote Psalm 88. And then Ethan, who was a companion with Asaph and Heman in the temple worship, he wrote Psalm 89, or attributed with Psalm 89. So here are the authors, the writers of the Psalms. Okay? So the question is, what are the Psalms, you know, what benefit, right, can they have? What can they do for us? Just arranging, I forgot about this, arranging the Psalms. If you'll notice in your Bibles, a lot of times it'll say book one, you know, the first part. Well, originally they were collected into five books. Okay, Psalm 1 through 41 was book 1. Psalm 42 through 72, book 2. 73 through 89. 90 through 106. And 107 through 150 is book 5. And most people believe that this arrangement seems to be put in, but maybe based upon the type of material, right, that was in those Psalms. So that would be like an arrangement of the Psalms, if you will. As far as the value of the Psalms, all of you, if you've done any reading at all in the Psalms, you can see how valuable they are, how wonderful they are. Okay? There's not a time, okay, now listen to me, there's not a time, whatever that you're going through, that you can't find a Psalm, okay, that can help you. Okay, if you look for it, okay, you can find some Psalms that'll help you in those things. Maybe you're struggling, maybe you've committed a sin and you know that you need to make it right with God and you don't know what to say. I'll go ahead and tell you, brethren, Psalm 51 is a psalm you need to turn to. You need to turn to Psalm 51. You need to read it and you need to put it on your heart and you need to pray it to God. It's a psalm of David after his sin with Bathsheba and going through it. And it's a wonderful psalm and it's something that all of us struggle with sin from time to time, and we need to go to God for help. And that's just one psalm. There are many. But it's something that it can all help us with. The value of the Psalms, they can be the Christian's hymnal. Okay, some of the songs that we sing are directly from the Psalms. Okay, they are literally psalms that have been put to music that we know, tunes that we know. And if you'll notice in our books, there are actually some tunes that we have to other songs that they have turned around and they put the words to a psalm into it. Okay, and it's a good thing to go through because, you know, we have certain melodies we know, you know, by heart, right? We know the melody, but we don't know the words, and they put those psalms to them, and it's a way to sing those songs. But once again, what I talked about, it can also be the prayer book of the Christian. It can also be a book of Christian evidences. It proves who the Messiah is. There are many messianic psalms that point to Jesus, okay? And so the psalms can help us. And it can be a training guide for living justly and righteously before God. And it says the psalms can just help us to appreciate and make verbal expression of our relationship with God. And sometimes, I don't know about you, but sometimes I don't know what to say. Sometimes in my prayers or something, and I struggle with what to say and how to say it. But brother, you turn to the Psalms, like I said, and you can find some words. Sometimes it can help give you encouragement to say something to someone else. Okay, and it can give us the words that we need. These Psalms are inspired by God, as all of the Bible is. And so please keep that in mind. They're wonderful words to help us. Value of the Psalms. What did Jesus think about the Psalms? You ever wondered about that? You know, Jesus lived after all the Psalms were written and all the, you know, the Old Testament thing. What did Jesus say about it? In Luke chapter 24 and verse 44, then he said to them, "These are the words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all things must be fulfilled which were written in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms concerning me." So notice that Jesus is saying, he said, these are the things that are written in the law of Moses and the prophets and the psalms concerning me. Jesus thought that the psalms were inspired as well, didn't he? He thought they were important. He didn't leave them out. He talked about them. If Jesus thinks they're important, then you know what? We need to think they're important too. We need to look at them. We need to get benefit from them if Jesus thought they were important as well. So, there's my introduction. Okay, so let me talk to you. You ever had this thought? You ever thought that? You know what? I think wickedness is winning out. There's just a lot of things going on in the world today and all kinds of stuff going on. Is wickedness winning? And I'll tell you what I want to thank THANK, Brother Keith, for leading the songs that he sung. He asked me this morning what I was going to be preaching about. When I told him, he kind of scratched his head a little bit. He's like, oh no, I'm going to pick a song out for that. And I'll tell you a minute. But there's a song, the first song that we sung, Till the Storm Passes By. I want you to listen to verse 2 again. Listen to verse 2, the words. Many times Satan whispered, there is no need to cry, for there's no end of sorrow, there's no hope by and by. You ever felt like that? What's the use? There's no hope. Wickedness is winning. Everything's going bad. Everything's going, we know what, we might as well just give up, right? There's no use in it. Let's just don't even try. But listen to the rest of the verse of the song. But I know thou art with me, and tomorrow I'll rise where the storm never darkens the skies. Beautiful words. Beautiful song. By the way, this song was inspired by another song. Okay? And so there's so many things we can learn. But I want to ask you the question. What do you think about when wickedness is winning? Every day we see what seems to be an ever-increasingly wicked world. We see the threat of war as evil men vie for power. We see the threat of terrorist attacks by some that are we would call religious fanatics. They try to live out their conceptions of certain teachings of certain men. We see promotion of sinful lifestyles, whether it's fornication, homosexuality, same-sex marriage, pornography. People trying to teach us things about evolution. There is no God. It's all about this. It's all about that. We live in an age that people call evil good, and they call good evil, like Isaiah talked about. We see the religious world around us, and we look at it and we say, you know what? It's the grip of what we would call maybe a carnal gospel that caters more to human convenience than spiritual conviction. It may be enough to conclude that, you know what? Wickedness is winning the battle in this world. It's times like this that we need to look at a psalm. And there's one in particular I want us to look at tonight. And I want us to look at the second psalm. And it's something that we've looked at in years past and things. But I think we need to be reminded. Okay? We need to be reminded of things. And so let's look at it together. Let's look at the first three verses of Psalm 2 to begin with. I tell you what, before we even do that, let's just do this. Let's read the whole song, then we'll go back. Let's do that. It's only 12 verses long. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and against His anointed, saying, let us break their chains and throw off their shackles. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. He rebukes them in His anger and terrifies them in His wrath, saying, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy mountain. I will proclaim the Lord's decree. He said to me, you are my son. Today I have become your father.
Ask me and I will make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your possession. You will break them with a rod of iron. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. Therefore, you kings, be wise, be warned. You rulers of the earth, serve the Lord with fear and celebrate His rule with trembling. Kiss the Son, or He will be angry, and your way will lead to your destruction. For His wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are all who take refuge in Him.
The first three verses then of Psalm 2, the second psalm. And by the way, I was going to get to it later, but we'll go ahead and just real quickly now. This is a psalm that in the New Testament, and we'll get to that in a little while, is attributed to David, okay, as David being the writer of this psalm. This psalm doesn't necessarily have the signature of David on it, but in the New Testament it tells us that it was David that wrote the psalm, okay? So Psalm 2 and verse 1, David says, "Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers to take counsel together." And what are they counseling against? "Against the Lord and against His anointed, saying, let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us." I want you to think about this. The nations are pictured, okay, as seeking to throw off the rule of God and His anointed one. They imagine that together, they can come together and that they can plot against, they can plot and with their joint power, they can overcome the rule of God. That's what they're thinking. They think they can come against God and defeat Him. Notice that it says, "Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing?" Right off the bat, the psalmist is letting us know that this is futile. What they're trying to do is futile. Okay, you're not going to be able to defeat God. It doesn't matter if every nation in this world comes together and say, "You know what, we're going to get rid of God. We're going to burn every Bible that there is. We're going to do everything that has the name of God. We're going to take it out of the schools. We're going to take it off any buildings that there are. We're going to do everything we can to get God out of everything." And what he says is they're plotting a vain thing. It's not going to work. They're not going to succeed in overthrowing God. Okay? A lot of times we look out in the world and we see all of the things going on and a lot of the things, whether it's people trying to take God out of everything or maybe someone is over and they're pushing the theory of evolution. Okay? And they're saying, "You know what? There is no creator. There is no intelligent design. We're just all here by chance. We're just all here." And what they're trying to do is they're trying to throw God out so they can just do what they want to do. So there is no moral law for anything. You do what you want, you think is best. I'll do what I think is best, and we'll just live life the way we want to. And there's no value in life. And that's why, you know what? I was watching something actually this morning. Early this morning I was watching a thing, and this guy was interviewing people. And he said, "Okay." He goes, "You love your dog, right?" He said, "Oh yeah, I love my dog." I said, "If your dog was drowning, and then there was a man that was drowning right beside the dog, and you could only save one, which one would you save?" You know what most of the people said? Said they'd save their dog. Well, guess what? If there is no God, and you're not made in the image of God, and there's no more value to you than it is to a dog, then that's what you would start thinking. And see, that's why all of the wickedness that's out in the world and all of the things, that's what people's reasoning is getting to when they get God out of everything. Then all of a sudden that dog is just as precious and just as valuable as a human being in their eyes. What if you take God out of everything? What's going to happen? Does that mean God's going to die? There won't be any more God? If every nation in this world decided to get rid of God today in the name of God and everything about God, what would happen? And what he says here, He says the nations can rage, they can conspire, they can plot, they can do all things, they can set themselves against the rule of God and against His anointed one, and they can say, let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us. What's going to happen? What's God going to do? Well, let's keep looking, right? What's going to be the response of the Father? What's he, is he going to shake in his boots? Is he just going to fall back and die? He's going to just bow down to man? Bow down to the creation? Is he going to say, oh yeah, you're right and I'm wrong. Oh no, what am I going to do? Notice it says, he who sits in the heavens shall laugh. First of all, it says that God's going to sit. He's not pacing around. He's not worrying. He's not concerned. He's not going to worry about his plans being overthrown or his will or mankind destroying his will and all those things. He's going to sit. And he responds, it says first that he laughs. Now I want you to make sure you understand something. He's not laughing because he's amused. He's not laughing because they're making him laugh because they're doing something funny. They're not doing anything funny from that standpoint. But what he's laughing about, it is absurd to think that those that God created can overpower their Creator. That is absurd to even try to think that that could happen. God laughs them to scorn. His laughter turns to anger as he sees those he created rebel against him. Notice he acknowledges that he has a ruler on earth too. Notice what it says again. The Lord shall hold them in derision. Then he shall speak to them in his wrath and distress them in his deep displeasure. Yet I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion. He's saying, you know what, you can come together and you can plot against me, you can plot against my son, you can do all these things, you can do anything you want to do. He goes, you know what, I've set my king up. My king has been set up and there's nothing you can do about it. There's not a thing in the people in this world that are going to take Jesus off his throne. There's not a thing in this world that they can do about it. It is through this king that he is installed on Mount Zion that he will terrify those who oppose him. Look at verses 7 through 9. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will give you the nations for your inheritance, and the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. He tells of what God has said to him. First, that God has acknowledged him as his son, his only begotten son. Second, that God has promised him victory over all his enemies. God has promised victory to Jesus over all his enemies, that through him they will be thoroughly destroyed. Let me tell you what, brethren, when you get to thinking that wickedness is winning, you need to go back and you need to think about who God is and who Jesus is, and that he set up his kingdom, he set up his king on his throne. And no kingdom of this earth is going to overpower God. And it doesn't matter if someone tries to get rid of the name of God or tries to burn all the Bibles or try to do this or that or even destroy all of God's people that are on this earth. They're not going to thwart God's plans. They're not going to thwart his will. God's anointed is speaking. Look at verses 10 through 12. He gives advice then to rebels, those that are against God. Now therefore, be wise, O kings. Be wise, O kings.
Be instructed, you judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear. You ever heard that before? Right? He's given us a second chance. If you've rebelled against God up to this point, He goes, you can still be wise. Be instructed. Serve the Lord with fear. And rejoice with trembling. Now this next verse, I love this verse. The New King James Version says, kiss the Son. S-O-N. Kiss the Son, lest He be angry and you perish in the way. Now this idea, when it says kiss the Son, He's saying you pay homage to the Son. You bow down, submit to the Son. You submit to Jesus, lest He be angry and you perish along the way. When His wrath is kindled but a little, He says you will perish if His wrath is kindled but a little. You know what? We have no idea. We have no idea how powerful and how awesome our God is. With just a little bit of wrath, we will all die. We will all perish. But He goes on to say, blessed are all those who put their trust in Him. Blessed are all those who put their trust in Him. The prophet urges all who rule on earth to understand that God and His anointed rules. And brethren, we need to remember that. I'm afraid we forget that so often. We forget that so quickly, don't we? Because we're used to living in this world and we're used to seeing our rulers and our president and our Congress and our Senate and all these things. And we're used to seeing rulers of men. And we forget there's an all-powerful ruler. Instead of rebelling against God, those that rule on earth should reverence Him and rejoice before Him. Instead of rejecting His Son, they should do homage to Him and obey Him. And there's a word of comfort to those who believe in God's anointed ruler. The second psalm is a wonderful psalm, isn't it? It's wonderful. Now look, it's quoted some in the New Testament. And it kind of helps us a little bit to get a good understanding of what this psalm is about. In Acts chapter 4 and verse 24, this is where the psalm is actually ascribed to David. Acts chapter 4. And we're not going to have time to read all of the context, but you can go back and read that on your own. But Peter and John in verse 23, they had been in prison. They had been before the Sanhedrin. They had been thrown in prison for preaching and teaching the gospel, right? And so they were released from them. And notice what it says in verse 24. So when they heard that, they raised their voice to God with one accord and said, Lord, You are God, who made heaven and earth and the sea and all that is in them, who by the mouth of Your servant David have said, why did the nations rage and the people plot vain things? The kings of the earth took their stand and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against His Christ. Isn't that interesting? He changed the word in the psalm. Second psalm, it just says, and His Son. He tells us right here, and the Christ. But notice He's attributing this psalm right here, the psalm we're going over, to what happened, them trying to destroy Jesus. What happened when Jesus was born? What did the rulers of the earth try to do? They tried to kill all the babies, right? So, we'll stop it. We're going to stop this. They're going to stop this kingdom before we get started. We'll kill all the babies. Well, they couldn't thwart God's plan, right? God protected His Son. God protected. Man's not going to be able to destroy God and His Word and His will. He cannot do it. And so Peter and John was thinking that at this time, and that's what they're attributing back to this psalm, thinking that God is always ruling. Look at another passage from the New Testament. Acts 13 and verse 33. It's 32 and 33 together, but we'll look at just 33 here. Paul. Now there's a couple of interesting points here. One thing is this. Paul calls it the second psalm. You know, we've always talked about, well, man, you know, put the number and the order and all those things of the psalm.
Paul calls this the second Saul, which is interesting. Or maybe it was to me, or maybe not to you, but it was to me. Okay? It's the second Psalm, right? And so Paul calls it that. God has fulfilled this for us, their children, in that he has raised up Jesus. As it is written in the second Psalm, there it is, you are my son, today I have begotten you. So he actually attributes that part of the Psalm to what? To the resurrection of Jesus. That's how when he says that you are my son, today I have begotten you, he had begotten him when he raised him from the dead. And that's what he's attributed to. So this is the second Psalm in the New Testament and how it is used for us. So we don't have to guess, okay? And a lot of times, you know, we want to try to conjecture and we want to do this. We don't have to guess what the second Psalm is about. It's about Jesus, right? Okay, it's about Jesus and God's plan working out through Jesus all the way from his birth or his predictions or all the prophecies through his birth, through his life, through his death, his burial, and his resurrection. And now he's reigning as king. That's it. That's what the second Psalm is about. And guess what? There's not a kingdom in this world that can do anything about it. There's not a person in this world that can do anything about Jesus and being saved through Jesus. So, brethren, you don't have to worry. Okay, I don't have to worry about what's going to happen in this world as far as wickedness winning out. It's not going to happen. Okay? Now, guess what? Now, our country is in a decline, and we can be concerned about that. We can pray about that, and we can try to get people to turn back to God. But don't think that they're going to win out. Wickedness is not going to win out in the end. Now, our country may go down and continue to decline because of wickedness. Because we see that all in the Bible, right? And the Bible tells us that righteousness exalts a nation and sin is a reproach to any people. Proverbs 14:34, right? We know that. But brethren, God's will is always going to win out. God and His Son, His King that He set on Zion. Okay. So what does it mean to us? We kind of looked at what does the Psalm mean, what is it about, who's it about, all that. What can we learn from it? What can we do? Well, number one, we need to keep in mind, always remember that God is still in control. Okay, no matter how wicked our country gets, no matter how wicked our rulers are, and how far our rulers go away from God, God is still in control. And we need to hold on to that. Okay? The earth belongs to the Lord. Everything belongs to God. He is in control. And whenever He decides that He's going to call a halt to this whole world, guess what? That's when it'll happen. It's not going to be when man tells us it's going to happen. It's going to be when God says, okay, enough's enough. But we need to remember God's in control. You can look at Psalm 24:1, Acts 17:24. Paul talks about that. But God is in control. Number two, it is futile to fight against God. It is futile to fight against God. I get caught up. In Acts chapter 5, 38 and 39, it says, therefore, in the present case, I advise you, leave these men alone, let them go, for if their purpose or activity is of human origin, it will fail. But if it is from God, you will not be able to stop these men. You will only find yourselves fighting against God. You remember, this was... I can't find his name. Pharisee named Gamaliel, teacher of the law, who was honored by all the people, stood up in the Sanhedrin and ordered the men be put outside for all. And this man addressed the Sanhedrin, and this is what he told him. Okay, and what I want you to see from that is, what he's trying to say is, if God is behind something, you're not going to be able to overthrow it. It is futile for us. And we all realize that. We understand. We need to keep that in mind. You cannot fight against God and win. Number three, God and His anointed
will be honored and their purposes will prevail. Those are things we get from the second Psalm. We need to hold on to that. You need to remember that. God and His anointed will be honored. Just like in the Old Testament. Leviticus chapter 10, Nadab and Abihu. You remember? They offered strange fire before the Lord. It was fire that He had not commanded them to offer. And you remember what happened? God struck them dead. But then He turns around and He tells Aaron, and you're not to mourn for them. They can't mourn for His own children. He says, because when someone comes before Me, I will be regarded as holy. If Aaron and them would have mourned for him, they're supposed to be serving God in the temple and all the things and doing the things that God prescribed. If they were showing mourning, what would they be saying? God shouldn't have done that. I can't believe He did that. I'm all sad. I'm lost. He said, I will be treated as holy. We are to honor God and His Word. We have no right to go against God. You remember what Paul tells the Philippians in Philippians chapter 2, verses 8 through 11. Philippians chapter 2, verses 8 through 11. Talking about Jesus, says, and being found in appearance as a man, He humbled Himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore God exalted Him to the highest place and gave Him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Every tongue will acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord. All men will submit to Christ. Now here it is. This is the crux of the whole matter right here. Sooner or later, you're all going to bow down to God. If you do it now, voluntarily, in this life, you will be blessed in the life to come. If you do not bow down and submit to God now, if you fight against Him, and if you rage against Him, and you conspire against Him, and you go along with all the nation of the world, says, I'm not going to be constrained by God, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to bow down. Then guess what? You're going to do it. You'll still do it, but you'll do it involuntarily on the day of judgment. And you will be punished for eternity. And that's about as plain as I can say it to you. There's only two roads that we go down. All of us are going down a road. Which road are you going down? Number four, we learn from Psalm 2 is those that oppose God will suffer wrath and punishment. You cannot oppose the Creator of the world without any repercussions. And finally, brethren, those who take refuge in God will be blessed. God loves each and every one of us. He does not want the nations to conspire against Him. He wants the nations to turn to Him. He wants each individual to turn to Him. He loves you. He cares for you. That's why He sent Jesus down to die for you to begin with. So that you can go to heaven. And all you need to do, brethren, is turn to Him and trust and obey. We're about to sing the song, Trust and Obey. And this Brother Keith found this. And notice the verse that's in it. Blessed are all they that put their trust in Him. Psalm 2 and verse 12. You want to turn to Jesus tonight. No matter how powerful evil may seem, God is in control and His cause will be victorious. Let's keep that in our minds. Let's keep that on the forefront of our hearts. And let's remember that and let's live for God. Okay? Put your faith and trust in Him. And live for Him. We can help you in turning to God tonight in simple obedience. We can help in any way. Please come while we stand and sing.